Hello.
Hello, and I have the recording on so we can start from jump. Can you hear me okay this time?
I can totally hear you.
Yay! All right, so we had a bit of a technical difficulty, and as you stood by, we rewound and started again. So hello, here we are with part two of the previous thing. If you haven't, don't start with this part. Listen to the first part first, because now we're going into more other stuff with Jean-Patrick and Coco, the kitty, as a special occasional guest, as cats occasionally are. So I want to rewind a little bit because we were talking about whether or not the wedding at the plantation with the all-black staff scenario would be okay. People who were consensually involved in the scenario, and the question became an interesting dichotomy between those people who would be fine with hiring actual black people who were just doing it because it was a job and trying to work past the intrinsic racism and horribleness of it versus kinky people who were like, yeah, this is a fucked up scenario. I'm going to do it because it kind of turns me on. And yeah, I'm a professional bottom, so wouldn't this be really great? And how most non-kinky people would see that sort of appalling and kind of creepy.
Well, and quite a few kinky people would still see it as being appalling and kind of creepy, right?
That is correct, but probably for different reasons. They
Yes.
would have an issue with the scenario versus having an issue with the fact that you were doing it as part of a job. You know,
Yes.
I think I mean, some kinky people are certainly judgmental against those who do sex work, but I think by and large, if you were to say to someone, "Hey, you know, I'm a bottom, I'm a submissive, I'm a dominant, I'm a top, and there are people who can use my services," most kinky folks would say, "Okay, great." They might then become a little bit more judgmental if they were aware that the scenario that you were being paid to enact was something that was challenging for them on a personal level. Whereas
Yes.
a non-kinky person would be appalled that you were being turned on at all.
Yes. But it's and it's interesting language to use, right? I mean, it's interesting language to say that you would be turned on. 'Cause and I feel like sometimes it's going to be like you brought up the example of, the nice young gentleman who's bringing you your salad course. And you look down and he's sporting a massive erection. That's that there's
I'm sorry, the mental
there's
image behind this is so exciting for me. I need a moment.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
All
Proceed.
right. That the so thinking outside of the sort of sex positive bubble that we happy folk like to believe that we exist in, there's like a whole shit ton of world out there that isn't really sex positive at all. So the idea of anything being, the idea of service being eroticized is inherently difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
The idea of problematic, of how can I put this? Of historically problematic, reminiscent service being extra eroticized is even more of a problem.
Yeah.
And my question, I suppose, is how much of it, how much of it, how much would it be more of a problem both outside the sex positive bubble and inside the sex positive bubble?
There would be some problems that would be common to the idea of people being made uncomfortable by seeing stuff reenacted once they're aware of why it's problematic. Obviously, these white Southerners involved in this particular situation don't see the problem with the scenario on its face.
Do you really think that they don't see a problem with it?
Yes.
Or that they see the problem with it and they don't care?
They don't see the problem with it. This is part of the thing, and I just spent an hour at a party in Sweden trying to explain this to
Okay, all right.
very progressive Swedish people. The issue with the depth of racism in America is not the people who are aware that they're racist. It's the people who are racist and prejudiced and don't know that they are. For someone to say, "Oh, the plantation, the Civil War, the antebellum South, it's a romantic and wonderful thing, and of course to recreate it, of course you have black people because that's how it was." To say that with complete lack of irony or awareness, I see it, you see it, but those people are not sitting there thinking, "Wow, that is incredibly indicative of a mindset that's deeply problematic." They don't understand that their privilege and the history of blood and rape and torture and genocide upon which that particular aspect of American culture is built is horrifying. They have the rose-colored glasses on and they don't see it. And so it's very different than someone standing there in a hood with a flaming cross saying, yeah, I see you and I want to kill you because you're different. You can take those people and here. The other folks who possibly could be educated but don't see that they need the education are a different issue. So no, mm-hmm. I don't believe that Paula Deen would strap on a robe and burn a cross, but I think she has no idea how her prejudice is so deep that she doesn't see the problem. You know, and I think that there are many, many, many people who fall into that category. And that's the category that I smash my head up against walls against, because I'm like, how can I? You don't even know that you need to hear this. What can you do?
Right, but I guess I'm wondering if there's not a third category, which is the people who see the problem and just don't give a shit.
Oh yeah. Those people are definitely there. That is.
Yeah. Okay.
I got no question about that.
I also had this image of the band. Like the band for the wedding being in full KKK white hoods and robes. That was the wedding band for some reason. That
wedding party, because they would, in order to protect the pure white womanhood from the staff, you would certainly need an escort because, you know,
oh, Jesus.
That was created to protect white womanhood because they're completely incapable of A, protecting themselves, and B, they are property.
And right.
Defend your property, you know, your farm, your woman, your dog, your chickens, your land, right? So what's interesting to me, and I had this pointed out to me by doing a Google search and pulling up my name quoted in an article about another really challenging event, but similar but different, also taking place on a plantation, where a bunch of gay white men were having a retreat in collusion with a bunch of gay black men. And they all went off to the plantation. The gay black men were all bucks and slaves and available for the use of the gay white men. And all this was pre-negotiated, right? The folks who were involved in this plantation-style retreat were well aware of what they were getting themselves into and volunteered themselves to come and have this particular retreat. And every year they do this. And apparently it's been going on for quite some time, which is unsurprising, considering that...
Yeah.
That when gay men want to get their sex on, they are hardly limited by the bounds of polite society. God bless them. There was a picture from the retreat, ostensibly, that featured two white guys in jeans and cowboy boots and cowboy hats. And between them was a black man stripped to the waist wearing, you know, some sort of denim overalls kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, have whips hanging off of their belt, and they're standing up on a platform in front of a crowd that looks to be full of mostly white people, from what I could tell. And hanging up behind them is this huge Confederate flag. And, you know, one guy's pointing off the distance, and this is supposed to be an auction where apparently this buck was being sold off to the highest bidder. And I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, well, wait, hold on a second. Would you really have a Confederate flag up there? I think, you know. So I'm like, my first question was.
You were looking for period authenticity?
I was like, I don't know that they'd have the Confederate flag up there. I'm like, if this was an auction, it would be pre-Civil War. I mean, not that auctions didn't still happen, but I don't know that you would, you know. So I'm having this whole, you know, question in my head, and I start to do the research, and I realize, okay, this is how, you know, how deep the perversion goes. And then my second thought was, damn it, why is it that only the men get to do this? I would not be able to, because I'd be curious as to what that experience would be like. And when I say I would be curious, it's not necessarily because I'd be running around thinking this was hot and sexy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But to experience anything fully, you know, myself as an actor and as a performer, part of what is in my DNA is how does it feel to be someone else? And living in a society where I am other all the time anyway, to just dive even deeper into that is fascinating. And that's part of the reason why people are so drawn to and repulsed by any sort of play that really gets you out of the chronological, physiological reality of where you are. You know, that's part of the reason why stuff like rape and incest and racial differences,
mm-hmm.
and oppression, and all of these things that are so deep and so horrifying are also very much of a draw, because that the psychological drama of it is heightened even more. And that's a part that I wonder if people who don't engage in SM really get. They look and they say, oh, it's whips and chains and it's weirdness, and that's it. And it's like, sometimes it is, and sometimes it's all you need, and sometimes it's this other thing that goes a lot deeper, you know. And again, like I say, I don't know if this is something that's organic to the United States, but I do know that everywhere I've gone, when you talk to people about the othering or the dominant culture versus the culture that was smashed, crushed, and killed and destroyed to create the one that is on top right now, everyone has that. Even in, you know, like I was in Ireland and we were talking about, they asked me to do a class on taboo play. And I'm like, well, who's the underclass here? And you started hearing about travelers and you're like, well,
mm-hmm.
that be a challenging scene. And I tell you, like, the air got sucked out of the room, you know, because he were a bunch.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, someone's like, yeah, you really hit a nerve with that. And I was like, good, fine. Fucking Irish people thinking, well, we're all whatever. But then, you know, then the conversation turned to, well, what if you were to do a Catholic Protestant scene? You know, can you tell the difference between a Catholic Irish person and a Protestant Irish person? I couldn't. They certainly,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's universal. It is a human problem. And so to use alternative sexual approaches to dive into human problems is challenging for so many people. But I think it's also deeply fascinating. You know, I mean, I'm sure up in Canada, you have many, 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 many levels of cultural differences, well, in appropriation, and so much going on so much.
For sure. And the, when you were talking, I was trying to think in my head if I've ever seen or heard about a scene involving a scene involving a white dominant and a First Nations submissive. And I can't say that I have. I have not heard of that happening. It wouldn't surprise me.
Too, you know? Yeah.
I think maybe, I don't know. I think you're right in that it's something that is, that not only notions of otherness, a recognition of the sort of social cultural status that comes from your race, class, sex, whatever else, is universal.
Yeah.
It does play different in every country. The Ireland example is good because you might not be able to externally recognize the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant, but I would hazard a guess that somebody could bring up, if that scene was going to happen, some like really deep, pardon me for using the word, like deep trigger actions or language or direction or whatever that would really like, that would completely hammer that scene home.
Yeah, absolutely.
And make it powerful and difficult and, you know, hopefully, not probably, but hopefully positively cathartic for both people involved.
Right, right. And the
right.
It's very, reasons and intent and motive are really important for me, which is part of the reason why I look at the Paula Deen plantation situation. And allow me to pause hilariously. When I went to search for a news article on this and I put in Paula Deen plantation and, you know, Google comes up with the suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
And two things came up at the top. It was like Paula Deen plantation grits recipe. And Paula Deen plantation iced tea recipe, I believe, was the other. And I was like, okay, wow. So if we needed further evidence of the tone deafness of the situation in question, there you have it. Because is that harken back to the days of plantations. You know, here are these tasty grits.
I'm gonna have to put myself in some context here. I haven't done a great deal of travel throughout the United States.
Huh.
basically, when I'm thinking about sort of the East Coast,
sure,
I've been to New York, I've been to Chicago, I've been to Boston, I've been to DC, and I've been to Tampa. So there's like a whole mess of country there in the middle that I haven't experienced.
Sure.
The other coast is the other coast. I'm not really talking about that right now. I just sort of feel like from a country,
let's give a shout out. Woo, middle of country.
Yeah. I can't believe I just said that. From a personal sort of visceral experiential perspective, there's probably something about spending time in the South that I just don't get.
Yeah. Well,
that makes it easier for me to speak about this with a certain lack of historical awareness, a lack of cultural awareness, both sort of historical and present. And so my conversation about it is more of trying to think of the way to phrase it. Like, I almost want to say pop cultural awareness, but that's not right either. But when you talk about Paula Deen planning a wedding, like I just immediately start thinking about the wedding magazines that would feature that. I start thinking about the photos that would surface. I start thinking about how could she possibly avoid the cultural commentary that would arise? Would she even think about avoiding it?
It clearly did not occur to her. And this is the thing, you know, and I will say to you, I have several levels of bias when it comes to the South. I'm not necessarily like, hey, I'm a bigot and I'm proud of it. But because I encourage people to embrace their own and embrace and own their own shortcomings, I will say I'm a Northerner growing up in New York. So you have the automatic North and South, Northerner, Southerner thing, where there's this sort of like fuck the North and fuck the South kind of thing. And there's that separate and distinct first and foremost. Then you have me as a Black person descended from, you know, my family came from the South and we're ex-slaves and we're sharecroppers and all of that. So I have a bit of an issue with the South with the Southern slaveholding states, right? So my cultural context is minimal, and the exposure I have had to racism and racist stuff that's happened has only been peripheral because I haven't gone to the South very much, because my feeling is, why would I go to a place where I have that much higher of a likelihood of having a situation where, you know, I sit down, I try to go get dinner and I'm not served, or I try to get a hotel room and despite
sure.
that we just called and we're told rooms were available, the second I walk in, suddenly they're not. My thing is, look, you know what? If you know that it's a bad neighborhood, you don't go there. If I know that I'm just going to have a blood pressure spike, you know, I'm just not going to do it. So, you know, and I will turn around on the other hand and say, I know plenty of Black people who live in the South, love the South, have awesome lives in the South. Plenty of white people who live in the South who are not racist fuckheads. And so there's that. People are going to be people everywhere is the other thing. So, but do I think that in this particular instance that no one checked their privilege? That along the way it took sort of blowing up among other people on the staff who finally, it sounds like, kind of just got fed up with it and were like, come on, really?
So there certainly is that. Now, because the other thing that there had to be is she had to pitch this idea, and the couple who were getting married had to sign on. And so there's those two families that had to sign on. Like, blind eyes piled on top of blind eyes piled on top of blind eyes.
It's like, for example, there's some new TV show coming on called Devious Maids. And it's,
yeah, I saw a commercial for that.
Right, and it's all like, you know, sassy Mexican maids in Beverly Hills, is it? Hollywood, whatever the fuck. You know, and the intrigue and whatever else. And I'm like, oh, great. Now you're actually hiring a bunch of Latinas to work. Thank fucking God. Oh, wait. They're all maids. They're maids? Really? This is the Jesus Christ. And you have to know that in order for a show to have gotten to the point where it's about to air, hundreds of people with power had to say yes to it. And yeah. Think it was okay. And test audiences and all of that other thing. And I'm going to say at some point someone said, you know, having a show about maids, about Latinas and having them be maids might be a problem. Overridden. You know, I would hate, yeah. I'm not going to say that no one said anything. I'm sure that someone did, but they were overridden. You know, you couple that with, and you compare and contrast that to the fact that Cheerios did a great commercial where they have a little girl who appears to be of mixed descent, and they cut to mom and she's white, and they cut to dad and he's black. And it's a very cute commercial about how adorably kids process information. And suddenly there are millions of kilobytes of hatred being spewed on the internet over it. The fact is that racism is a thing that is so deep here, and blindness to it and defensiveness against the blindness is something else. If someone says to me, hey, you said something that was kind of fucked up. Here's why it's kind of fucked up. My first thought is, okay, my bad. I wasn't aware it was fucked up. Please educate me. And I sit and fucking listen. And then I act appropriately. I've seen many, many times where, you know, you mentioned to a white person, you're like, hey, that was kind of fucked up. Let me tell you why. And they're like, well, I'm not a racist. Well, it's not my problem. Well, you're being sensitive. And this is immediate defensive. And that situation, there's what can you do? What can you say? How can you bridge that gap? There's no freaking answer for it, really. It's just another hypothetical question of frustration and rah, rah, rah.
Well, I feel like in that situation, it's not your job to bridge that gap. It's their job to bridge that gap.
Oh, but they're not. You know, it's difficult to try to explain it. And I find myself consistently in a position as an educator where my educator hat goes on regardless of the situation. You know, like I'm going out to San Francisco for the Folsom thing, and I was invited to present some classes, and they're like, okay, we'd like you to do this class, and we'd love you to do the race play class, and could you maybe do a demo? And I was like, okay, here we go. I will add that it is actually rare that I do demos with this class. The main reason is that teaching and doing a demo when you are the teacher is really tough. Because you have to present, you have to do a demo, and then you absolutely have to come back and talk about it. You can't have the demo be the thing that you do, and then you drop the mic and walk off, because that would be leaving your class in a very weird limbo. And so when I'm doing demos of other technique, you know, to sort of like do a scene, even if you hold back and you try to stay conscious, to come back and be like, derp, I will now impart to you pearls of wisdom, derp, derp. Is tough. Yeah. You add to that the fact that it's going to be a charged and difficult scene, even if it's just 3 minutes. You know, it becomes really tough. And so then it becomes the issue of, oh, okay, do I want to do this demo? What's the demo going to be about? What's it going to be like? Who am I going to get to do it? Who is the audience? How much time do I have? What am I looking at in terms of whatever else? And so that degree of trying to weigh the balance between sensationalizing something that I don't want personally, like, I don't want to be seen as something that you just do for fun and shits and giggles, versus saying, this is important to me. This is a vital aspect of BDSM, not the race play part of it, but the edge play part of it. You know, doing something that can be spiritually fulfilling and is part of an ordeal pathway towards sexual enlightenment and awesomeness. I think it is vital for people to see that. And I have received amazing feedback from people who've said, I've seen you do these demos and it changed my opinion on X, Y, and Z. And
okay.
Important, yes. And so part of the thing I do when I'm faced with problematic situations is I jump into like, but wait, I can explain this and you'll understand.
Yeah. No, I get it. It's funny because while you were just talking, one of the things I was going through my head was because I was separating in my head, you use the word technique, and And sometimes I wonder if there are certain kinds of classes, and I've thought this in the past, if there are certain kind of classes where the inclusion of a demo, while it may be eye-opening and while it may change an opinion, as you're saying, if it's depending on the subject matter, if including a demo is too much, is possibly giving the impression that this is how you should do it.
Right.
Part of my background for, because I'm actually realizing too that there's probably a good number of people who are listening to this who have no fucking idea who I am.
Well, whatever.
Besides Canadian with a cat. Right?
Have a bio thing. How's that?
Yeah, that's okay. So when I think about classes and workshops, because I'm predominantly a rote person or have been, you know, mostly studying rope for the past few years, and I think about technique classes, it's very regimented in terms of what technique means, and being able to separate like learning time or lab time from intention loaded scene time has always been really important for me.
Right. And I would say that different than a rope class where there's like, here's how you can avoid nerve damage,
mm-hmm.
for example, and there are concrete things you can say that are some stuff that's going to be black and white, right or wrong, and then there's some things that are a choice and aesthetic, yada yada. Mm-hmm. When I do a demo in my class, it is purely a demonstration. It is not instructional, and I make sure to let people know. I'm like, what you're doing actually is now being allowed into a really private / possibly sacred and definitely personal space. This is not for me to show you how to do what I do. This is for me to show you why I do it. And,
okay.
And for you to see a personal moment of interaction. It is not a blueprint, you know, and I give all of these caveats before I have done anything. I'm like, it's not a blueprint. I wouldn't follow this script. And the person who is the top with me in those scenes, first of all, they have always been people who themselves are instructors.
Yeah.
That's very important because they have to know how to hold an audience, explain themselves, and come back after a scene, right?
Yeah.
And so just across the board, someone who is even the most skilled player might not have that skill set. And so part of the negotiation I do with the people when I've done these demos is sit with them and say, all right, so you know you're going to have to like swim on your own for a bit with this class and talk about your side of this, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that has its own challenge. But no, you're right, and I appreciate you making that distinction. It is not a demonstration of technique.
Yeah. And the other thing that I've always thought is, we're getting close to time, which is interesting because I feel like the notion of using demo in classes, using demos as part of a class structure is interesting because the thing that always makes me think of is intention, engagement, and time.
Okay. So let us pause with the we'll do another chunk. We'll start off remembering that we're fucking talking about demos and intention, engagement, and time. So jot it down so we don't forget.
Yeah.
And then what we will do is we will chop this and do a part three, because then people will be like, oh my god, what are they going to say next?
It's like one just leads into the next, just leads into the next.
Thank you for listening, and come back soon for part three.